So what do you love about that three-dimensionality in terms of sculpture and then translating that into video? Well, that sounds like a logical departure, but how did that begin?
Well, over the years, I start exploring quite kind of broad range of media related, mostly related to specific ideas or subjects. So my transition from three-dimensional work to actually initially to paintings and photography, or even actually I did some carpets in Nepal, was just a result of my investigation, my research, and understanding that if I want to talk about specific issues or specific ideas, I have to use different language. So it was just natural progression of finding the better formal way of expressing myself.
Was that an easy transition for you, or was it, I'm so frustrated with this material and sculpture, I need to broaden my scope, or was it just a logical, okay, I need to go to multimedia?
It was logical in the sense that I have always have an interest in film. It wasn't very easy, mostly because I have a kind of great respect for the medium itself. So, you know, and one can see a lot of boring videos all over the place, and artists are kind of jumping on this video very,
yeah,
and kind of great enthusiasm. I'm not saying that my work is not boring, but I'm hoping I'm not. But I'm very much aware of the difficulties the media is presenting itself, and also certain easiness which creates a problem. I was able to, over the last few years, produce, I think, over 9 video projects, but I'm still, I'm still learning, and probably always going to learn.
As you worked your way through this, what was then a new process, and using film, which you respect, what sorts of, I'm going to use the cliche, obstacles did you have to overcome, but I mean, what I'm interested in is what you've learned along the way, and how you've improved your art as you've progressed.
Well, the major issue, obviously, it's time, and so understanding a certain... I mean, obviously, right now, it's extremely easy to shoot video. I mean, one can produce hours of material. So the editorial process of actually making those decisions and trying to, like a dramaturg, trying to find the right tempo, right, build up some story or working with those visuals in a certain manner, which will keep the audience attention, but also will be still kind of, on many levels, attractive. In this particular video, which is a little bit maybe different because it's a loop and it's designed to be a video installation, so it's supposed to kind of run endlessly and one can kind of walk in and walk out at a certain time. It does not require to be seen in the hall. Finding the kind of the balance between the visual, the sound, and certain movement, certain dynamic, but the same kind of relatively monotony of the process, like the way the monotony of the melting landscape, which is actually presenting. Actually, each project, in a sense, always produces its own difficulties.
We'll zoom in then on Uber Navik, in this case, Kievan Repu, and find out some specifics. First off, describe the region. You mentioned it already, Uber Navik. If you could describe for listeners just the course of this seven-minute-ish video, which, as you mentioned, is on a loop that you did in 2010. What are people going to see?
Well, Upper Navik itself is a small island off the coast of Greenland, but it's surrounded by a number of large glaciers, which are kind of spitting huge amount of ice all over the area. So what you see, actually, you see the imagery created or produced when the boat is relatively high speed or lower speed, different speed, running through probably about 20 miles of the ice fjord, surrounded by thousands of icebergs. And the camera is placed just above the water, and the day was beautifully calm, and there was a perfect, almost like a mirror reflection of those icebergs in the water. So the camera is kind of recording double reflection of those icebergs and the icebergs themselves, smoothly running between those huge mass of ice. We have a skipper who was pretty reckless. We were on the plastic boat, and there was so much ice, we were kind of afraid that at any point we can actually hit huge mass of ice and we all go down very quickly, but he was he was fearless, and that was also allowing me to create this footage. In the meantime, you're actually hearing the sound of repetitive sound of NASCAR race. It's slightly muted and slightly transformed, but create a kind of repetitive loop which one can experience when one is standing in the middle of the NASCAR racetrack, where the cars are kind of coming and going because they're going in the circle. So the sound is kind of coming closer and leaving one and going away. That creates kind of eerie effect, almost like space travel. The sound is relatively, obviously, the combustion engine we can recognize. And one cannot say that this is really space travel because space will not hear any sound.
That's right. In space, no one can hear you scream.
Right. But we are used to the sound of the Star Wars. So
that's right. We'll let you get away with it this time.
Right.
I can understand the genesis of or the inspiration for capturing NASCAR sound, given your location there in Charlotte. But how did you come up with this initial concept in broad strokes, the cinematography aspect of that? Was it in process while you were on site there that it dawned on you? Or did you go in kind of knowing this was the camera angle you were hoping to use? How did that grow?
Well, this particular film is part of the whole series of three films, and one is called Hold On, Give and Repu, and Wave Around. And they're all based on this kind of juxtaposition of polar landscape with the NASCAR culture, NASCAR racing in visuals or sound, or one particular Wave Around is actually using imagery of the NASCAR fans. And my initial process was, or inspiration was, pretty much looking at this big global event, such as global warming or climate change in general, through the prism or through the kind of point of view where I am right now, in living in this place, and also NASCAR as a kind of representation of, I would say, our general way of entertaining ourselves. But, you know, the car culture in general, it does represent our attitude towards resources and civilization and environment and many other issues. So NASCAR, obviously, it's an exaggeration of car culture, but it does represent certain values and certain way of spending time and entertaining thousands of gallons of gas just burned for our fun.
It's interesting to me how you're taking a combustible engine that's been with us for a century or more, and then you put it in this context, and suddenly it is Space Odyssey, especially with the images, the mirror effect. Really, at times they look like spaceships floating through the air.
Yeah, but you know, in a way, when I actually, because I spent some time, number of races, right in the middle of the track, and when one is actually dropped there in the middle, one actually feels like in out of space. I mean, a lot of races at night, the movement and the sound of the cars is absolutely overwhelming, and it's eerie and unreal. And people, I mean, I could see a lot of people really getting almost kind of the level of height and being excited to the kind of surreal environment and deafening sound of those engines. It's just transporting one to this state of, I don't know, probably for many ecstasy, but it's powerful. It's really powerful.
Some would say we're dealing with an environmental film and charging ahead with combating global warming and NASCAR is emitting all these carbon dioxide poisons that are screwing with the ozone. But in fact, you're admitting to the intoxicating nature of the dance, of the race itself.
Yeah, I mean, I'm not a fan of the race, and it's not really my thing, but it's like guns. I'm not a gun owner and I have no interest in gun culture, but I recognize the sexiness of it. I recognize the element of this attraction people have with guns, sense of power or empowerment or weaponry in general. And many people talk about it. I never had the chance to actually experience it, but I can relate to that. And I think it's in a way the same way. I'm not claiming to be totally objective observer, but I felt like it's in a way my obligation to find the connection, my personal connection, where I am living in this particular part of the country, in this country, and looking at those global events and how they all related somehow. And certain level of ambivalence, absolutely. And I think that I will always kind of be afraid of being extremely judgmental. I own the car. I drive the car as well. You know, I use going to many places, especially the remote places. You know, I fly to those places, so my carbon footprint automatically is gigantic. And in order for me to go to those places like Northern Greenland or a couple of years ago, I was shooting film in Queensland, Australia, in Great Barrier Reef, you know, going there, being on a diving boat for weeks, that's tremendous effect on the environment itself.
The fact that you go to the extent of, if not empathizing, but trying to understand the allure for, and you mentioned guns, and in this case, NASCAR, it seems like that's a roadmap for really bridging gaps of understanding or at least communicating with people that you knew about that a long time ago.
Well, thank you. I don't know if I knew a long time ago. I started this project in 2004. this kind of division between so-called believers and not believers, I hope people maybe will act less aggressive in kind of trying to convince other people and find the more, you know, so-called soft power to bring those issues and actually build them on the specific examples. I mean, this Hurricane Sandy is a maybe good example, but, you know, a few years ago I did a project in my hometown in Poland, which was called Urban Heat Island, and there is phenomena in large urban centers where, because of the development and people's activity in many places, in large cities, probably New York and any other, you can find the temperature different, you know, especially in the winter, quite big between the center of the city and suburbs, up to 7, 8, maybe 15 Celsius. And that's huge, and that's actually easy way to measure our impact on the environment. I mean, right away, I mean, one can see the difference between the temperature of the air outside of your house in the middle of the town or somewhere in the suburbs.
Right. All the pavement and smog and trapping gases, the heat that necessarily rises.
Yeah. The buildings themselves, which are actually, you know, obviously leaking the heat, the concentration of cars and people, activities, everything, it really creates almost like a microclimate.
What's your hope in terms of audience reaction to your work in this installation? And I'm speaking of Kivan Repu. What do you hope people leave the exhibit with?
I have to say that my own understanding of this film, it's got already a couple of years or more, and the perception change. You know, I looked at this project also because my research kind of evolved in the context of our perception of climate and all those big events. I kind of moved towards post-colonial theory, and I look at this film more through the eyes of kind of imperial melancholy. You know, we destroy things and then we cry about that. And that's the way for me personally is. If people will look at it right now and have some kind of moment of pause to think about the remoteness of this environment and how surreal it is, in the same time how much we are depending on it, because we do depend on it, that would be success. We have this strong, I think, kind of romantic relation to the nature. We look at it kind of as explorers and people who romanticize the landscape and kind of have this idealistic approach. But the reality is probably much more crude. And in particular, I think what was interesting for me to go to Greenland, which this film is maybe not showing, is the fact that for Inuits in Greenland who are still under strong colonial influence of Denmark and rely on the Danish government on subsidies, they look at the climate change as an opportunity to finally reach to their resources and get independent. It's not every Greenlander, but a lot of people think about it this way, that for them it's the opportunity to finally become absolutely independent, free, and rich.
Could you fill in the blanks for me there? I've only thought of it in terms of less ice, so it's more difficult to grab seals, for example. Or I don't have any point of reference there. But why would the melting lead to independence? Could you fill those blanks in for me?
There is number of mostly international companies, actually a lot of Australian companies, which over the years research access to minerals, natural resources in Greenland. The permafrost and the ice cap is preventing them to access them on a large scale. The cost prohibiting, you know, it's just too expensive to get to them. The fact that ice cap is shrinking, obviously it's shrinking kind of going from coast to inside, is allowing them to much cheaper reach those resources, and they will. So Greenland as such got political independence, but economically still dependent on Danish government, which is subsidizing almost everything from education, healthcare, transportation, and so forth. There is no education beyond high school, for example, in Greenland. One needs to travel to Europe. So they see this as an opportunity to, in a way, become less hunters-gatherers, you know, but become more industrialized nation with, you know, all the benefits of the economy, which will pick up automatically very quickly.
It seems like 200 years ago, the Wild West or unexplored areas were an attraction that would gravitate people to go there. I was reading a National Geographic article about this Antarctica exploration around the turn of the last century. That's just fascinating. What drove these people to put their lives on the line to go see this stuff? What was in it? And yet today, when communication is so ubiquitous and you can see scenes, just go on YouTube and you get a scene in Bali or Borneo or wherever within seconds, it's almost like you just push it aside. Like, it's okay, that's really exotic, and I'm not going to go there, so I'm just going to look at it on my iPhone.
Well, I have to tell you that I, like I said, in 2004 or 3, when I started reading articles and books and trying to understand this the whole situation, and there was a lot of material I could actually use, and which I did use, like satellite images of ice cap or glaciers all over the world, and I started this way. And then I realized it would be very silly of me to just claim any knowledge or understanding of those events if I will not go there. And the first trip I did was to Alaska, and we have a false perception through media, you know, or National Geographic including, that we know about those places or the events or phenomena. We don't. I mean, unless you go places, you actually discover very quickly the kind of how complex and multifaceted it is. And my initial trip to Greenland was sponsored by American Scandinavian Foundation in New York, and my proposal was focusing on exploration of Norseman culture, which disappeared in 14th or 13th century in Greenland, and they were not able to adjust to climate change. So when I actually got to Greenland and I started researching the kind of post-colonial reality of life in Greenland in relation to climate change and political issues, I learned a lot which I have no idea about, really. So I'm always a little bit afraid of kind of claiming the knowledge about things, even if I go places, because I realize how complex and three-dimensional they are in many ways, which we often have those, you know. I did a lot of projects about the war before I started the climate, and I always felt like we're getting the kind of synopsis version through the media. We really have no clue. And, you know, I recently have a chance to show my work from the beginning of the war, which actually was centered here in Charlotte. And we have this whole panel and we talk about war in Iraq and how much we know right now. But, for example, we still don't know how many Iraqis die in Iraq. Nobody really knows.
Yeah.
As a result of invasion and as a result of the violence among Iraqis. So it's a false perception, in my opinion, at least.
And unless you're there, you don't have any sense of it.
Yeah, and I think we increasingly, because we feel so connected, we're getting news on our iPhones or whatever, and we feel like, oh, I know. We don't. We really don't. I mean, in many cases, the story is just getting so simplified, and it's just quick snippet, and it's dying so quickly that nobody have actually time to explore and understand what actually happened. We're just moving to another vignette of information.
Yeah.
This particular film I'm showing at Wake Forest, it's also kind of relates to my interest on formal level of the term kind of developed in Germany called Kunstwissenschaft, which means science of art, and was formulated by this German philosopher Marx Dessoir. And he was trying to categorize in a way to find what will define art, what are kind of elements of aesthetic experience one should find in art. And I think this film does have those five elements, which are called, which is beautiful, sublime, tragic, ugly, and comic. And I think that's in a way kind of was a key to this film for me, that they, in a way, it's beautiful. It's also scary when you're there. It's tragic. Some of those forms of those icebergs are people can find ugly or comic as well.
Perfect. What a great summation. I mean, all those things you set up there are inherent in this little film there. I call it little in the best sense, but it's relatively short. But I can see that it's very palpable the way you describe it there. The comic, the tragedy, the sublime, the beauty, and it's all there.
Yeah, I think so. I hope so.
Well, congratulations. You've caught it all.